Yeah, let's start this morning in 2 Chronicles chapter 9, where we left off last week. 2 Chronicles chapter 9. We are nearing the end of the material that is in 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles about King Solomon. And we're paralleling between 2 Chronicles 9 and 1 Kings chapter 10. So let's go ahead and pick up here in verse 22 of 2 Chronicles 9 and read down through verse 28. So 2 Chronicles 9, 22 through 28. See, Brother Aaron, can you start us off here this morning? In verse 28. All right, so this is really continuing where we left off there at verse 21 last time. The Queen of Sheba had come from her place in southern Arabia, had journeyed to Jerusalem to hear the wisdom that God had given to Solomon. She had many questions that she came to get answers to that were obviously of a spiritual nature, wanting to know God and know His will. And Solomon was able to give her answers to all the questions of everything that was in her heart. We saw her excellent example in her desire to know the Lord, and to the extent to which she was willing to the effort that she was willing to make in order to seek God. And God rewarded her for that, uses her as an example. Jesus does in the New Testament, as He will use her to give testimony on the Day of Judgment, as she journeyed as far as she did to hear the wisdom that God had given Solomon. And how about those with the wisdom that God gave to His own Son that He sent? What will the answer be for those that are not willing to listen to Him or put forth any effort to hear that far greater wisdom that God has revealed through Christ? And, of course, that is applied to the generation that was alive in Jesus' time, when they didn't have to travel anywhere. He was going to their places, and they still wouldn't listen. So they will be condemned in the Day of Judgment, and God's going to use the Queen of Sheba and her testimony about what she did and how much effort she went to hear the wisdom God gave Solomon as a testimony against that generation. But we also considered last time, reminded ourselves of what we have available to us right here. We don't have to go anywhere either to be able to find that wisdom that God has revealed through His Son. We have the complete revelation of God to mankind here, all things that pertain to life and godliness, and how far do we have to go to find it?
About an arm's length,
exactly. I mean, really, and if we're not willing to expend that kind of effort, as easy as it is for us to access this, and we don't care enough to even put any effort into it and diligently seek the Lord, I mean, what are we going to have to say on Judgment Day when the Queen of Sheba speaks? I mean, He's going to use her in condemnation of that generation in Christ's time, but we won't fare very well either in that if we're not going to seek God. And we have an excellent example in her of how much she valued God's wisdom, how much she loved the Lord and wanted to know about Him and wanted to know His will so she could do it. And we need to be the same way. And so she departed after she had also given a great present to Solomon, which it gives us details of here in this chapter. And then Solomon also gave much to her. He gave things to her that she had asked for, but also he gave things to her from what he had chosen. And so that's also mentioned there. And then it goes on to talk about the amount of wealth that Solomon had. And we saw there last time how it mentioned the weight of gold that came to him in a year, verse 13 here in 2 Chronicles 9, 666 talents of gold. The riches, the jewels, the exotic animals, and I mean just everything was coming to him from all over. And it goes through all of that, and all that, and what was silver like in Solomon's time in his kingdom? It was accounted as nothing. I mean, there was so much of it; the value was negligible. And it's just very difficult to even conceptualize how much wealth was present there at that time. And it also there described his throne at the we get down to verse that section down to verse 21. And how elaborate his throne was, and also even the vessels that he drank from, pure gold. So it's just an astounding amount of wealth. And Brother Michael even gave us a translation of how much that would be in our time. And I mean, it was gold of tons, worth billions every year coming in. So that summary we have in verse 22 here, King Solomon passed all the kings of the earth in riches. That should be very, very obvious from that description that he then adds to down through verse 28, how much he had, the horses and chariots, cedar trees. I mean, sycamore trees were like cedar. It says there the cedar trees he made like sycamore trees. For their abundance there. I mean, it was vast wealth of all kinds that he had. So he gives us those numbers. And it is very difficult to relate to those numbers. I mean, they're so vast. But the point really is there in verse 22 there that King Solomon passed all the kings of the earth in riches. Well, in two things, riches and wisdom. And of course, what did Solomon ask for when God gave him that opportunity all the way back there to the beginning of this book of 2 Chronicles and even in 1 Kings chapter 3? But when Solomon was given that opportunity to ask God for anything he desired, what did he ask for? Yeah, he wanted a wise and understanding heart to judge God's people, Israel. And he gave him that wisdom, but then God said he was going to give him also what he didn't ask for. And it included that wealth and made him richer than anyone else that's ever lived. I mean, there's no one that can match this kind of wealth that he's describing there, and nobody in modern times. And we noted last time, last week when we were looking at some of that, there was a reason for that, and those two things that he mentions, the wisdom and the riches. Did God need someone as an example for mankind for the riches and the pleasures of this life? I mean, how big of a stumbling block is that for people in general? I mean, it really is. What is the root of all evil? According to 2 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 10. What is the root of all evil? That love of money. I mean, the desire, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes. And then there's the pride of life. I mean, those are the things of the world that he mentions in 1 John 2:16. The devil was successful in deceiving Eve with those evil desires back in the garden in the very beginning, and he's been successful in deceiving and mankind ever since. I mean, this is one of the devil's major weapons, and a love for money is the root of all evil. Covetousness, the desire for pleasures, earthly pleasures and the things of this world. It's still right there at the top for stumbling blocks for mankind. If we love the world, can we love the Father? I mean, that's 1 John 2:15. When he says, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. The world passes away in the lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abides forever. So we have 1 John 2:15 through 17 that teaches us those things. Jesus taught the same principle, Matthew 6:24, also Luke 16:13, in both places. He said that we cannot serve two masters. We will either hate the one and love the other, or else we'll hold to the one and despise the other. He says you cannot serve God and mammon, material things. It's impossible. We can't serve God and also material things. We cannot love the world and love the Father at the same time. It's an either-or choice that has to be made. And the devil's tempting us to seek after and to love these material things. So was it important for God to have an example to give to mankind that all these things, these mammon, and that's what all those riches are, those pleasures, mammon, material things, that mammon is not the answer. As Jesus said, a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. Did God need to have an example to give to mankind to prove that? Somebody that would have, when we read about it, we can't even relate to the numbers of how much wealth is there. Well, obviously so. I mean, why did God give Solomon all that? Now, did God give Solomon all of that to try to destroy Solomon? No. Now, did it almost destroy Solomon? Yes, that's the next chapter in 1 Kings that's coming up, in 1 Kings 11. But that's another reason why, if God was going to give somebody this kind of wealth, if they were going to get through it, and once again, as we mentioned last week, how effective would the example be if the richest man that ever lived was destroyed by all of that? Was unable to learn the lesson that's all vanity and vexation of spirit. That would not be the effect of that lesson would not be, if it was just another grand failure, that would not quite have the same impact, would it? But the fact that God would give somebody this kind of wealth, and that in the end he would be able to learn the lesson of what those things are about, and then be able to tell us what really is the conclusion of the whole matter. That is extremely important. And for somebody to be able to have all of that and get through it, to be able to be that example and to be able to teach that lesson effectively, how much wisdom did that man need from God to get through that so that in the end he was able to escape with his soul and be able to teach us those things? I mean, we should be able to see why those two things went together with Solomon. So Solomon asked for wisdom. God gave it to him in abundance, unlike any other. And then he gave him that wealth, and then gave us the example. And Solomon, if we go to the book of Ecclesiastes now, this book, it starts by stating in the very opening line of the book, the opening words of the book of Ecclesiastes, the words of the preacher. He doesn't ever identify the preacher by name in the book of Ecclesiastes that he is Solomon. But we know that he is. And it's not because we're guessing. There are statements made about this preacher. And he's preaching. He's preaching on the subject of mammon in this book. And he's preaching that it's, very next verse, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. So he starts right away by telling us what those material things and the pleasures of this life, what it's worth. It's empty. It's nothing. Vanity and vexation of spirit. He's going to say that over and over again. But this one who's preaching on that subject here is Solomon. And we know that. Look at some of the description right there. Well, what's the first thing we know about the preacher there in Ecclesiastes 1:1?
Son of David.
Yes, son of David. So we know he's a descendant of David. Now, is it possible, I mean, even in the Bible, do the scriptures sometimes identify someone as being a son of someone, referring to the fact that that they're a direct descendant, not necessarily meaning they're the immediate son of? Well, was Jesus called the son of David? Yes. Now, of course, we know he was not one generation removed from David. He was a direct descendant of David. That genealogy is important. He was the rightful heir to the throne of David. So that's well established. But to say that someone is the son of, it does mean that he's a direct descendant. We wouldn't be able to say from that necessarily that that meant he was the immediate son of David. Of course, we know Solomon was. But the statement in verse 1 says he was son of David. So we know he's a direct descendant of David. Well, that narrows it down a lot, doesn't it? I mean, that narrows it down quite significantly. So we know from verse 1 of the very first verse of Ecclesiastes that this preacher is a direct descendant of David. So however many of the male descendants of David there are, he would have to be in that group. But there's much more about him that's revealed than that. And as we continue to look at some of the information about him that's given in Ecclesiastes in chapter 1, verse 12, it's narrowed down a whole lot more by what it says in verse 12. What does Ecclesiastes 1, verse 12 say about the preacher? I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Now, how many sons of David were king over Israel in Jerusalem? That narrows it down to one. All right, how many descendants of David were ever king in Jerusalem? Now, we're leaving out the over Israel part there. How many sons of David were king in Jerusalem? 19. Starting with Rehoboam, or actually 20, including Solomon. Solomon and then Rehoboam all the way down until we get to Jehoiachin and Zedekiah, the last two kings that were kings of Judah. So there's a grand total of 20 people that were descendants of David that ruled as king in Jerusalem. That's it. So now the preacher, we've narrowed it down to one out of 20, except for we have that other part of the phrase in verse 12, over Israel. Now, from Rehoboam through Zedekiah, all of those sons of David that were king in Jerusalem were king over what? Not over all Israel. The kingdom split after Solomon. That's what we're going to start reading about in chapter 11 and chapters 11 and 12 in 1 Kings. As punishment for when Solomon went into sin before he was recovered and repented, and we have the book of Ecclesiastes as the result. God still gave a punishment that the kingdom would be divided. 10 tribes were given to Jeroboam, and that those 10 tribes of that northern kingdom were referred to as Israel, the tribes of Israel. It was the vast majority of them. The remainder, there was the southern kingdom, of which Solomon's son Rehoboam ruled, and that was the tribe of Judah, along with Benjamin, the smallest of tribes, and that was referred to as the kingdom of Judah. So how many sons of David ruled over all of Israel as king in Jerusalem? One. And Solomon, he was the only one. So from what we have in Ecclesiastes 1:12, we know that had to be Solomon just from that alone. Well, we also know that it can only be Solomon for some other statements about him. Verse 16. He had gotten more wisdom than all that had been before him in Jerusalem. All right. Well, we know it's a son of David who had more wisdom than all before him. That has to be Solomon because of what we read there in 2 Chronicles and 1 Kings that stated about him his wisdom. We just read it there in verse 22 of 2 Chronicles 9. There was none that had the wisdom that Solomon did in all the earth. Certainly among the kings of Judah that remained so. And God told him there wouldn't be any after him. There were none before him and none after him that would be like him as far as that wisdom and riches were concerned. So God had already said that. Well, is it possible that someone who lived after Solomon had more wealth or wisdom than Solomon? That were the kings over Judah? Absolutely not. So verse 16 just adds to that even more. For example, we have a chapter 2 then, verses 7 through 9, when it's describing his wealth. And then he concludes in verse 9, says, "So I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem." And that's talking about his wealth. So if this isn't Solomon, then somebody would have to argue that somebody that ruled over a lesser kingdom of Solomon's descendants, over only Judah, actually had more wealth and wisdom than Solomon himself. That does not agree with the scriptures. You put all that together. This preacher, unquestionably, undoubtedly, is Solomon. It cannot be any other human being that's ever lived. Solomon is the only one. That's who this is. All right, so when we're reading Ecclesiastes, God gave him all that wisdom, gave him all of that wealth. And what was the purpose of it? Solomon states it there in verse 3 of chapter 2. Let's read Ecclesiastes 2, verse 3, Brother Samuel.
"Beside my heart to give myself as wise, and yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, until I hold on folly, until I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under heaven all the days of their life."
So do we want to understand what was the purpose for God's giving all of that wealth and wisdom to Solomon? All this wisdom and riches we're reading about. Why did he give that man all of that? Both. There's the answer. He is an example to be used as an object lesson for this purpose, so that he would see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. That's what it's all about. If God had not chosen someone to give all of those riches to, and then be able to have the wisdom where he could experience all of that, and also the folly out there to have it all, experience it all, and then be able to say, okay, now here's what God's creation, mankind, should do with their lives. Here's how we should live our lives. Here's the conclusion of the whole matter. There has to be someone that God could use to give us that conclusion that experienced all those things. If he didn't have all that wealth and hadn't experienced all those things, somebody could argue, well, he might think that that's the conclusion of the whole matter, but he hadn't tried this, or he hadn't experienced that, or he didn't possess this. But who could say that about Solomon? Who could say, well, he just didn't have enough riches? He just didn't experience enough of the pleasures of this life to really know? We can't say that, can we? He had it all. He lived it all. And that was the reason for, so he could then be used by God to tell the rest of mankind forever what they should be doing with their lives. And we have really this put in two ways, what we should and what we shouldn't. All right, on the shouldn't side, loving the world and the things of the world. Should we? What does Solomon say about that? Well, what did we just read there in the second verse of the book? And it's from there all the way through. About all these riches of this life and all of its pleasures, what does he say about all these things under the sun that pertains to just these material things?
Vanity.
Yep. It's all empty. It's all in vain. There's nothing to it. And if that's the road we follow to pursue those things, to enjoy those things, what are we going to have in the end? Nothing. I mean, it gets to the end of the book, and then he hones in on young people and tells them that at the very end of chapter 11, when he's speaking to youth in verse 9, "O young man, rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart, and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment." So the point is, therefore remove sorrow from thy heart and put away evil from thy flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. At what time in our life do we become very attracted to fun, to things, pleasures?
It starts early.
It really does. And that attraction is there for young people. And if we start down that road then, is it easy to get off that road? When is the best time to get this lesson ingrained, to know this is all vanity? And I'm going to end up being judged by God. Don't put it off till you're older. Learn it now. That's why we have then the very next verse in Ecclesiastes 12, verse 1. What should young people do? Instead of pursuing all of these vanities and loving this world, what should they do instead? Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. So there is a way that's not vain. And how does the book conclude? Verses 13 and 14. But Travis? What's that?
What's the reference again?
Ecclesiastes 12, 13 and 14.
Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil.
So what's the conclusion of the whole matter? Well, he's already shown us what we shouldn't live our lives for. So here's this man who's given all this wisdom, all this wealth, to give us this teaching of what the sons of what mankind should do with their lives under the sun. What's the answer? Fear God and keep His commandments. That's the whole duty of man. When do we need to learn that? From our youth. And never forget it. So we have that example for Solomon. So here's the one that had it all, experienced it all, to teach us what we should do. And he says, don't go after these material things. Don't follow that folly. It's all vanity, vexation of spirit. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Fear God and keep His commandments. That's the conclusion of the whole matter. That's it. That's what it's all about. Nothing else. So that's the life of Solomon and its purpose right there in a nutshell. So all those things we're reading about his wealth and wisdom here at the end of it, as he's summarizing his life, giving a description of all of that at the very end, as we had already seen it earlier. He's honing in on that point once again to remind us, here's the one that had all of this, but we should remember what he had to say about it all, as God was choosing him for that example, for that very reason. Okay, let's look at these last three verses of 2 Chronicles 9, and verses 29 to 31 there. Let's see, Vivian, you got that? 2 Chronicles 9, 29 to 31.
Now the rest of the acts of Solomon, first and last, are they not written in the book of Nathan the prophet, and in the prophecy of Ahijah the Shilonite, and in the visions of Iddo the seer, against Jeroboam, the son of Nebat? And Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel 40 years. And Solomon slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David his father, and Rehoboam, his son, reigned in his stead.
Do we have preserved for us all the words that God ever spoke through any person to mankind? I'll ask it again. Just listen carefully to the question, the way it's phrased. Do we have preserved all the words that God has ever spoken to mankind? No, not by word. Not even all of them. Do we have the majority? No. We have a fraction of it. Well, he names a bunch of books right there. God's had lots of prophets. Who was the first prophet? Well, we know God spoke directly to Adam, but he spoke to Abel as well. It's interesting when Jesus speaks about the martyrs and all the prophets, and he says, starting with Abel. And Jesus identified and mentioned Abel and directly calls him, refers to him as a prophet. So we can go back to the very beginning. Was Enoch a prophet? Who walked with God, that one that was translated. Well, Jude quotes Enoch in a prophecy that he made of the judgment day, the end of the world and the judgment. Do we have the book of Enoch? What do we have? Do you think God spoke one verse through Enoch back then? No. Noah was a preacher, preached 100 years. He's referred to as a preacher of righteousness in 2 Peter 2, and we know he was 100 years in building the ark. How much of what Noah had to say for that 100 years do we have preserved? So we have basically, in the book of Jude quotes Enoch, so we have basically a verse preserved for us of what Enoch said that God has revealed through Jude. We don't have the 100 years of Noah's work preserved for us. These other prophets, Nathan and Iddo and Gad and all these others, we don't have the books that were preserved through them. We could go on and on with that. What about, let's just not even consider all the Old Testament prophets and all the things that God spoke through them. And think of how long some of their careers were. I mean, how long did Isaiah and Jeremiah prophesy? I mean, for decades. And we might think, well, those are long books. Jeremiah 51 chapters, Isaiah 66 chapters. I mean, that's what they call the major prophets. Those are two of the longest books we have in the Bible. But how long, if you sit down and start in Isaiah 1:1 or Jeremiah 1:1, all right, let's say we went home this afternoon, let's go home this afternoon, eat lunch, and if we sit down and start in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 1, and just keep reading, you think could we read the entire books of Isaiah and Jeremiah before we assemble again tonight? With room to spare, we could. There'd be plenty of time for that, as big as they are. And those are all the words we have from two prophets, just two of them from the Old Testament, that God used to speak his word to the people of Israel for decades. Do you think we have all that they spoke recorded in written form in those books? Not by a long shot. What about all the things that Jesus said and all the things that he did? Well, the Gospel of John, the very last words of the Gospel of John tell us about the books that should be written if it contained everything that Jesus did. And what did he say about it? That's right. So here we have just a fraction of all the things that God has ever said to mankind using his prophets in his own son. We have just a small portion of all of that. We might think the Bible is big. It's not that big. It's not even but a small percentage of what God has ever spoken to mankind. Well, then we think, well, what of all that other information that was out there, and some of it only spoken, some of it written that we don't have anymore, maybe there's something in there that we really need to know that we don't have. That's the Mormon argument. It's a false one. What does 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3 say about what we have here? All things that pertain to life and godliness. So is there anything that pertains to life and godliness that was in the book of Nathan that we don't have? Is there anything that pertains to life and godliness that was spoken by Enoch, Noah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Jesus Christ himself that we don't have? We may not have every word they said, but we have all that we need. That's the point. In fact, 2 Timothy 3:16-17... where it says, all scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, instruction, and righteousness, that the man of God may be perfect, thoroughly furnished unto every good work. We have enough right here, all things that pertain to life and godliness. Jesus said all truth, John 16:13, and all things that we need to be complete and thoroughly furnished unto every good work. Now, how much more do we need than that? If we have everything that pertains to life and godliness, if we have all truth, and if we have all that we need to be spiritually complete and thoroughly furnished unto every good work, what did God ever speak that we don't have that we need? Nothing. So there's lots that he said. Did God say things over and over again? We have certain things quoted or taught more than once in the Bible. God has condensed all the material that he ever spoke and has given us everything we need. So do we need to worry about all the stuff that we don't have preserved? No. I mean, God preserved exactly every word that he spoke that we need to have to know his will so we can live before him, so that we can grow to be complete spiritually, to be thoroughly furnished unto every good work, to be prepared to live for him in eternity in heaven. We have it. We have all that we need. That's all. That's the end of that then. But it just drives on that point there, because we see verse 29 mentioning some books that we don't have. Then we have the mention again of Solomon and his reign in Jerusalem over all Israel for 40 years in verse 30. And then he died, was buried in the city of David, his father, and then his son Rehoboam reigned in his stead. And then we're going to see what happened to Rehoboam with the splitting of the kingdom. That's in the next chapter in 2 Chronicles 10. All right, well, let's go back over to 1 Kings chapter 10 so we can get to the same point in our reading here. So this is going to match up just about verbatim with where we finished up there in 2 Chronicles 9. Let's go ahead here and start in verse 14. Let's see, Brother Trey, can you read for us 14 through, let's get 14 to 22.
Now, the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 603 score and 6 talents of gold, besides that he had of the merchantmen and of the traffic of the spice merchants, of all the kings of Arabia and of the governors of the country. And King Solomon made 200 targets of beaten gold. 600 shekels of gold went to one target, and he made 300 shields of beaten gold. 3 pounds of gold went to one shield, and the king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. Moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with the best gold. The throne had 6 steps, and the top of the throne was round behind. And there were stays on either side of the place of the seat, and 2 lions stood beside the stays. And 12 lions stood there on the one side, on the other climbed the 6 steps. There was not the like made in any kingdom. And all King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None were of silver. It was nothing accounted of in the days of Solomon. For the king had seen a navy of Tarshish with the navy of Tyre. Once in 3 years came the navy of Tarshish, bringing gold and silver and ivory and apes and peacocks.
All right, so that's through verse 22, and let's see, Brother Peter, can you read 23 to 29?
So King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom, and all the earth sought Solomon's and his wisdom, which God had put in his heart, and they brought every man in his presence vessels of silver and vessels of gold and garments and armor and spices, horses and mules, arrayed year by year. Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen, and he had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, whom he bestowed in the cities for chariots and with the kingdom of Jerusalem. And the king made silver to be in Jerusalem as stones, and cedars made he to be as sycamore trees that are in the valley for abundance. And Solomon had horses brought out of Egypt and linen yarn. The king's merchants received the linen yarn at a price. And a chariot came up and went out of Egypt for 600 shekels of silver, and then a horse for 150. And so for all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria did they bring them out of their beauties.
It would not be a sufficient or thorough accounting of a man's wealth without including yarn. anyway, we can see how wealthy Solomon was. And just like we were reading in 2 Chronicles 9. And there's just nobody to compare to that, as we read. Now, we don't see the conclusion of his life given here at the end of 1 Kings chapter 10 like we did in 2 Chronicles 9. That's going to come at the end of 11, because we have one more chapter in 1 Kings. Now, we've had most of these chapters in 1 Kings that have lined up exactly in parallel with material in 2 Chronicles, and we've been going along with that side by side. Here we don't, with this next chapter, we don't. 1 Kings 11 is a standalone. The material in 1 Kings 11 about Solomon's wives and about Solomon's heart being turned away, the fall of King Solomon. It's only recorded here in this 11th chapter of 1 Kings. We don't have that material anywhere else. Of course, we don't have to have it anywhere else, but we have it only in this place, so we're not going to be following. We don't go back to 2 Chronicles until we pick up with the beginning of Rehoboam's reign, Lord willing. So that is to say, then, that Lord willing, next Sunday morning, we'll start in 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 1, and we'll be solely focusing on what is in this chapter starting there. Very important chapter. Keep in mind what we just went over today as far as the purpose of Solomon's life. When he was going through, and as it said, he gave his heart to know wisdom and folly. As he came to know that folly, was he able to escape every temptation? He fell to them. His heart turned away from God for a time. So he got caught up in all of that. What he concluded before it was too late was vanity and vexation of spirit. He recovered himself. He repented. But the fall into sin comes before the repentance. And his fall into sin is what we're going to start reading about in 1 Kings 11. And that's also very important for us to know about as an example. Here's what not to do. This goes right along with Ecclesiastes. This is all vanity and vexation of spirit. Solomon finds out the hard way on this, but he's used by God to teach us. Don't go following down the same path. 1 Kings 11 is also a great chapter for marital advice. Well, actually, premarital advice. Because once you're married, as you're going to see with Solomon, then you're going to be dealing with the consequences. This is excellent for young people to consider before you ever get into that situation. What kind of choice do we need to be making as far as who we're going to be spending our life with? What are our standards going to be? What are the things we need to be thinking about? And God's going to use Solomon for an example to teach us about that too. So we got quite a lot of very good things to look at and consider from what is revealed and taught to us in 1 Kings chapter 11, which we'll intend to do starting next Sunday morning.